Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to episode 87 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kesslering.
Today is Friday, September 18th, 2020. Some crazy events in the market this week. S&P 500 continues to trade down, but IPOs hotter than ever. And SPACs, oh my God, that market is just on fire, going crazy. That's really the focus of today's show. Going to start off talking about Chamath Palihapitiya of Social Capital, the SPAC master himself. He struck a deal for one of his blank check companies to merge with private real estate startup Open Door. We're going to chat about what the market thinks about this deal. Obviously, the market likes it, but we're going to talk about why the market likes this one. In IPO land, Snowflake, which we chatted about on last week's podcast, their shares absolutely surged triple digits in the biggest tech IPO of the year. Does its valuation here make any sense? Lastly, we wanted to give you an update on what's going on with TikTok and President Trump, which seems to be an absolute disaster, changing pretty much every day. They're now trying to work on a sale to Oracle, and the US may be banning the app this weekend. So how's this going to play out? But first, let's chat about Chamath of Social Capital, one of his SPACs. This one's called Social Capital Hedda Sophia 2. It announced a business combination with private startup Open Door, which is Silicon Valley, real estate technology firm, an online marketplace for buying and selling houses, so-called iBuying. They're doing this deal at a $4.8 billion valuation. This represents a valuation of 1x revenue, but I mean, they're not super profitable, so it's not really comparable to one of these asset-light type businesses. But nonetheless, versus their last valuation in March 2019 when they raised $300 million, Open Door was valued at $3.5 billion. So not a massive premium, not a massive jump in valuation from their last private funding round to a now go-public transaction with Chamath's SPAC Social Capital 2. Just wanted to give a quick overview on how Open Door works. Basically, they provide a quote to a homeowner that's interested in selling their home. This quote comes via an algorithm. Basically, they have the software that comes up with a fair price for them, where an owner can sell their house directly to the company. Then Open Door, after they buy it, they could make some fixes to the house and then put it on the market. So basically, like a real estate market maker buying and selling homes, counting the sale as revenue, but not necessarily profiting on it. So certainly quite a bit of market risk, you would think. Certainly a very capital intensive business, not your typical asset light software technology business. This is completely different, more of kind of like a bank or a big holding company, something that's very capital intensive. They're making money on the spread between where they can buy these homes and where they can sell them. It operates in 21 markets, sold more than 18,000 homes last year, so fairly sizable entity. As I indicated, a $4.8 billion enterprise value on this one. And Chamath, I call him the SPAC master because he's done a ton of deals. He's best known for doing the Virgin Galactic through his first SPAC, which was a very successful deal that closed last year. He claims that Open Door is his next, quote, 10x idea, implying he believes it can return 10 times his investment. Got a quote here from Chamath. He stated, "The company is transforming the $1.6 trillion residential real estate market by combining superior user experience, streamlined operations, and machine learning to create a seamless digital experience." But I don't know, I've never used this service. Mike, what are your thoughts on this Open Door deal?
Well, yeah, I guess first, speaking about the business model, as you'd mentioned, yeah, like it is analogous to a bank or a market maker where it is very capital intensive. But kind of from my view and looking at their some of the the materials that are available, looking into the business model of the company, is that it really seems like their model is to actually just come close to break even, or perhaps have a very slight profit on the actual buying and selling of homes, but really just using that as customer acquisition so that they can take care of the other services that are involved in the buying and selling of homes. So things such as title and escrow services, which which is way higher margin for them, right. Where they could actually make some real money. So that's what it seems like their real business model is, as well as recently they have had a little bit of traction with having some of their main cities being secondary markets, such as like Nashville, Charlotte, Portland, where you're taking advantage of that exodus away from you know, New York City and Los Angeles, San Francisco as well. But yeah, in terms of Chamath, like, one interesting note with him is, just look at his CNBC interview this week. I mean, that's what's gained a ton of press for this deal.
For sure.
And that's where he made the comment around it being his next 10x deal.
I can understand why a private company would want to do a deal with his specs, because he's a very exceptional promoter.
Yeah, so he's very good at that. And I'm not meaning that in a derogatory sense. He's very well spoken and he is promotional, and he provides a lot of excitement around the deal.
Well, and when you're running a public company, I mean, one of the major tasks of, say, the CEO is to get out there and tell the story of the stock to the market, such that you attain a good multiple and you do well for shareholders. I mean, the best case of this is Elon Musk. Look at what he's attained with Tesla. You know, he has a ton of critics, but all you got to do is look at the valuation, and that indicates that Elon Musk is by far a rock star promoter, better than anyone.
Exactly. Like, fundamentals aside, like, he has sold that into a cult-like following, which you can speak negatively about that, but you can't really discount that in terms of the company's success. So that's just another example where Chamath always mentions, you know, the IPO 2.0 with SPACs, and, you know, just looking at a company that's right now during their quiet period, say like Palantir, they can't do that. Peter Thiel is also very good at having a narrative. He is also an expert level communicator, but Palantir cannot do this.
So a major advantage of going the SPAC route as opposed to traditional IPO is the ability to promote the stock in the middle of the deal.
Exactly. And then just moving to the actual transaction itself, it's going to provide about $1 billion worth of cash for growth for the company, as it isn't generating cash flow.
Right. So that's over $400 million that's within the SPAC, and then a $600 million pipe deal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And where the interesting part of this deal as well is that 200 insiders are making up $200 million of the pipe. Chamath as well. He has a lot of involvement in these private investments in public equities.
Doubling down.
Yeah, certainly. And there is a little bit of Canadian flair in this deal in the pipe, where you do have Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan, HOOP, is also involved in that. But as well, what you do like to see when we're looking at these deals is that existing Open Door shareholders have agreed to roll over their equity. So there is no major exits.
Right.
This is all all this cash is going towards growth in the company, not just cashing out investors, which we never like to see that in an IPO.
Yeah, contrast that to Snowflake, and you have some exiting investors and exiting former employees and things of that nature. I always consider a traditional IPO perhaps a dumping ground for VCs and private equity firms, where they're like, you know, we're done with this, dump it on up, you know, the retail schmucks.
Kind of down the food chain, yeah. And one last thing just on the deal is the valuation. I believe you had mentioned the enterprise value of the deal, $4.8 billion. That's 1x 2019 revenue.
But is it really fair to judge this company, as you indicated, very capital intensive and significant market risk? I mean, they have this massive balance sheet tied to home prices. Is it fair to judge it and value it based off revenue?
Especially during, and that's where you would never look at a bank and judge them off of revenue,
right,
or other really capital intensive businesses like that. They're in high volume transaction, mm-hmm, like a market maker as well. But yes, yeah, so that's a valid point. But yeah, moving forward, you bring up a good point about market risk, is especially in times of volatility, mm-hmm, that you have this asset or assets and liabilities on your balance sheet that, you know, all of a sudden there could just be, you know, the bid-ask spread of the housing market could just completely widen where they're not able to transact anymore.
Yeah. I.e. the bids go away.
Exactly. And so
they're not able to sell
that. We have seen that happen literally within our lifetime in 2008. I mean,
right,
in Calgary here, we've seen that over the last number of years where it's been a difficult housing market. So they are exposed to that. But overall, very interesting deal. As I'd mentioned, I continually am very impressed by the marketing of Chamath. He's just an absolute expert in the space, and as you, I believe you alluded to, he has a bunch more SPACs coming out. I believe he did mention on that it wasn't the CNBC interview, it was on a podcast, that he has reserved IPOA to IPOZ on the NYSE. So we can expect a lot more SPACs, can't we?
Oh, certainly. And that's why we have crowned him the SPAC master. I think Chamath is running away with the title here from other potential candidates such as Michael Klein, Chin Chu, etc. What's crazy is basically an hour before we started recording this podcast is that Chamath's Social Capital filed for three more SPACs. That's right, three more. One was a $1 billion IPO, the other $600 million, and the third a tiny $350 million. But I digress. Obviously, the market loving this deal pushed up Social Capital Hedo Sophia 2, the SPAC that's merging with Open Door, up 20% on news of the deal. And yes, the bull market in SPAC deals continues. On to some IPO news. Cloud infrastructure startup Snowflake, their shares rocketed more than 100% in its stock market debut. It completed its IPO this week. And this is a head scratcher because initially when going out with an IPO, they set a marketing range in which they hope to go to raise capital at. And the marketing range for Snowflake was initially $75 to $85 per share, which some could view as aggressive because that was like double its private company valuation just 7 months ago from February. So they're bumping up the valuation double within 7 months. But what was disclosed in the IPO documents was that Berkshire Hathaway themselves, like the most famous investor, absolutely gold-plated reputation backing this deal, it was disclosed that they were subscribing to $250 million of stock at the IPO price in a concurrent private placement, plus buying over 4 million shares in a secondary transaction. And what's, I don't understand why Todd Combs would do this and not keep that private, because the market saw that, caught on, and said, wow, Berkshire's buying, I need in. And then demand just absolutely skyrocketed, which caused the marketing range to go from 75 to 85 to ultimately pricing at $120. So Berkshire basically negotiated against themselves and promoted the stock prior to buying. It's like
promoted it indirectly in a weird way.
Yeah,
right?
It wasn't. They promoted it indirectly by not keeping their interest private.
Yes.
Right. If they kept their interest private, the marketing range and the ultimate pricing would have been lower than the $120 per share. So they, in fact, and this is all just speculation, who knows, maybe it would have gone up like crazy. But, you know, going from the 75 to 85 to $120 per share, where Berkshire had to pay basically $40 per share more, ended up costing Berkshire Hathaway investors over $100 million, which is just crazy. I don't understand it. But I mean, they can't really complain because the stock closed above $253 per share on its first day of trading. So more than doubling, up 111%. Now, this surge valued the company at over $70 billion, which is nearly six times its $12.4 billion valuation from February, and 140 times its annualized revenue, which is just insane. What are your thoughts on, you know, the head-scratching move by Berkshire and ultimately the market's just wild valuation of this tech IPO?
And I guess first, with in terms of the Berkshire investment, is the where I believe the issue is that they pegged it to the IPO price. If they would have gotten somewhere in between the private valuation in February and the IPO price, that would have made sense.
Like they should have known that they're going to push the price up by disclosing that they have interest.
Well, and yeah, because they're by definite, like if they would have done just a private placement right before the IPO, that would have had to be disclosed in their S-1, but they wouldn't have been negotiating against themselves. And I do want to push back against one narrative that every media article you saw said that Warren Buffett invested in Snowflake. That is just not true. This is a Todd Combs deal. It's through Berkshire, absolutely. But we're just seeing so many folks in the media perpetuating this claim that Buffett invested in the firm, which is obviously pushing up the valuation. This is just not true. If we can put that to rest, that would be ideal. But I don't see that being the case in the future here.
You think Todd flipped out of the stock already?
It would be interesting.
Float traded on its first day or more than the entire float of shares outstanding.
I was asked by one of our listeners, actually, you know, whether he would have traded out. And I mean, Buffett wouldn't trade out on an IPO pop, but also Buffett doesn't invest in IPOs, and he doesn't do this anyway. So
well,
Todd does have a different strategy.
He did invest in the Ford IPO in 1955.
Yeah, it's been a while, I guess. But in terms of valuation, at its current market cap of, $68, $70 billion, keep in mind that their total addressable market that they mentioned in their S-1 is $80 billion. Like, this is like 0.84 times their total addressable market. That is, never mind revenue, like that's absolute craziness. Like, these assumptions that are being made with the valuation are assuming that they're going to capture more than 100% of their market, which, I mean, the company has a pretty good gauge on their own market, and they have every incentive in the world in their S-1 to, you know, pump their total addressable market up a little bit. They have no incentive to I guess sandbag on that estimate. So unless all of these investors have some insight into how they're going to expand that addressable market, I kind of highly doubt that.
Right, and what that 140 times annualized revenue multiple means is very lofty future performance expectations, because ultimately you trade on a multiple of earnings. And so at a $70 billion valuation, is there any margin of safety, any room for error in attaining, kind of growing into that valuation? Certainly a lot of hype and a lot priced into the shares here.
Certainly. And just let's go over a little bit of who did well in this deal. And front and center would be Frank Slootman, their CEO. He's been there, I believe, less than 2 years. But this is actually the third hot IPO that he has presided over.
He's got the Midas touch.
He certainly does, and that's very. It becomes very clear he is the third CEO of the company in this young company that's only around 8 years old. Third CEO, and they brought him in for a very distinct reason. And so, going back, Data Domain Corp. In 2007, he was the CEO of that company, where it did have a first day pop of 33%, and then sold for $2.2 billion a couple of years later to a company that is now controlled by Dell. And that was the result of a bidding war itself, that sales process. Then moving to 2012, ServiceNow, which is still traded, it did have a first day pop of 32%, and it has returned excellently for shareholders, 48% annualized since June 2012, and now has an EV, an enterprise value of $85 billion. So this is his third. His stake in Snowflake is worth, I believe, just under $3 billion as of market close.
Not bad for 18 months of work.
Exactly. And just mentioning, the founders also did quite well. I believe one of the founders had more of a stake than Mr. Slootman. But as well, Sutter Hill Ventures, which this company was actually incubated within Sutter Hill Ventures, which is a unique model for VC, typically not the normal route for a VC investment. And Sutter Hill Ventures, very difficult. You can't, like, they have nothing online that you can find about them.
Yeah, I never heard of them prior to this deal.
No, but they have had a couple of other large deals, but yeah, there is no self-promotion by them, but their stake is worth $11.9 billion. And I believe the initial seed round was done at around a $5 million valuation. And they have been involved in all of the financings moving forward, but just an absolute win in terms of
Grand
that for Sutter Hill Ventures.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have been made very, very wealthy in this deal.
Yeah, so they ended up raising $3 billion in their initial public offering, and this makes it the largest ever for a software company IPO, currently trading in the market under ticker Snow. Now, lastly, I wanted to follow up on this TikTok file that we've been covering, which is just an absolute mess, seemingly changes every day. First, it was expected to sell to Microsoft. Microsoft was gonna buy all of TikTok, then TikTok US, then, you know, maybe Canada and Australia. And now Oracle goes into the mix. Microsoft gets rejected. Now Oracle's gonna be a partner, and Trump announced that it will ban TikTok and Chinese app WeChat starting Sunday night as the government continues to take action. Really what this is about is the Trump administration suspects apps, Chinese apps such as TikTok and WeChat, of assisting the Chinese government in stealing Americans' personal data and obviously all these negative security ramifications. It's also related to why he's banned Huawei from 5G networks. They're very, very concerned about what the Chinese government could do to American consumers and government. So this threat to shut down TikTok comes amidst a supposed sale process. I mean, it was a sale process where parent company ByteDance was trying to sell off TikTok US prior to it getting banned, but that somehow morphed into Oracle becoming a what they call a strategic partner, and potentially TikTok US going public, in which Oracle and for some reason Walmart would buy a stake. So this file, things seem to be changing every single day. This banning on Sunday news came out of left field. That was just announced, I believe, this morning. But clearly Trump he acts in a way where he gets a hold of, you know, a certain notion in his head, and he just kind of stays on it like a dog. And this one is just addressing the government's security concerns with China. And his beef with China has really been a long-term play for him. Obviously, a lot of things that China is doing is very negative, and you know they're running this sort of nanny state with a lot of fingers within corporate China, and that's really what the U.S. government is trying to prevent happening within the U.S. economy. Now, this specific ban on TikTok that was just announced this morning, it only affects new downloads and updates of the TikTok app, so you can continue utilizing it if you like filming your dance videos or lip syncing, whatever it is. You can use it until at least November 12th, and that's when some technical restrictions will kick in. But to summarize this, who knows what's gonna happen here? It's seemingly changing every day, but what I do know is that Trump is going to continue his attack against China and successful Chinese companies.
Yeah, and I guess within the Commerce Department, I mean, just what I've read on this, there's a lot of conflicting statements made both publicly and then from leaks that come from the Commerce Department. So it's a little bit difficult to follow along here. But right now, really, as you had mentioned, Julian, TikTok users as well as WeChat users are not able to get updates or new downloads. And why that's the case, or why this is going to be, or how this is going to be enforced, is really just that The enforcement is going to be that U.S. companies will be banned from distributing WeChat and TikTok or doing business through those apps. So it bans U.S. companies, for example, from providing services or payments through WeChat. And then, as you had mentioned, that November 12th date is the kind of drop dead date for this at this point, as it's always a moving target. Yeah. As well,
I previously said September 15th he was banning the app, and clearly that did not happen because it's September 18th. And
and I will note, very interesting timing, it is a week after the election. So that would be what I believe it was Lindsey Graham had came out and said that he had lobbied the president not to ban the ban TikTok prior to the election, as I mean, there's a ton of people in the U.S. that use this app.
Well, 100 million, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So those are obviously there are children that use the app that are under voting age, but there is a very material portion of the U.S. population that uses this. It would be election suicide to do that right before the election. But yeah, that's where everything with this, it's all intertwined between politics and business. You know, it seems like this is partly a mechanism to push forward negotiations with Oracle. I really, through all the reports I've seen, it's kind of difficult to see what the status of those negotiations are at this point. As you had mentioned, it's just kind of a cluster, and we'll be monitoring it moving forward. But luckily, myself personally, I'm not a user of TikTok, so doesn't really matter to me personally. But certainly something interesting to follow along, just in terms of U.S.-China relations.
Yeah, the Cold War between the U.S. and China certainly continues, so it will be interesting to see. I mean, how that plays out, haven't heard a lot regarding the trade war that used to make the stock market go up and down. And then phase two, I mean, I haven't heard that terminology uttered for a very long time. Everything's been COVID, and now, you know, we're kind of past that, so perhaps they can get back to battling over trade and the current account deficit, or the trading deficit. But that's about it, ladies and gents, for episode 87 of the Absolute Return Podcast. Hope you enjoyed, and if you did, always check out more at absolutereturnpodcast.com. Definitely give us a shout out, give us a review, tell your friends and colleagues. Follow us on Twitter. Mike, what's your handle?
It is M_Kessler.
And mine is at Julian Klimochko. And until next week, wish you all the best in your trading and investing, and we'll chat with you soon. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.